This podcast is brought to you by the RNIB Children, Young People, Families and Education team in partnership with Fight Against Blindness. It's part of the Emotional Support series. This information will be useful for parents, carers and professionals who work with children with vision impairment and may also be useful for young people themselves.
Hi guys, and welcome to the second instalment of our Emotional Support podcast series. Today I'm joined by Karen Hurst. Hi Karen.
Hi Laura.
And Dr. Ian McCubbin. Hi Ian.
Hello Laura, thanks for having me back.
So Karen, if you just want to tell us a little bit about your role within the RNIB team.
Yeah, sure. So I have quite a long job title, which is Early Support Education and Training Manager. And essentially what that means is that I have a lovely job where I get to develop resources and training opportunities, all of which are aimed at supporting families on various elements of bringing up a child with vision impairment. A little bit of the work involves resources for professionals as well, but as I say, the majority of it is around supporting families.
Great, fantastic. And Ian, if you could just tell us a little bit about your role.
Sure. So I'm a clinical psychologist and I work at Oxford Children's Hospital. And I guess my role there is to support children and young people and their families, particularly children and young people who have a visual impairment. So I work alongside the ophthalmologists and optometrists at the eye hospital here. And I guess I get referred, anyone kind of from very young children up to sort of age 25. And my role is to support them with their adjustment to their eye condition or their sight loss, which can mean lots of different things. It can mean kind of ongoing psychological therapy. It might mean referral to other agencies. It might mean liaison with other professionals. Recently, it's involved doing little bits and pieces of research too. So it's kind of lots of different things, but hopefully all pulling in the same direction. And it's funded by a charity called Fight Against Blindness, or FAB. He'll be very keen to make sure I don't forget to say their name. It's all intended to kind of support the psychological well-being of visually impaired young people.
Great. So we are going to, today's session is going to focus on early years, and we're just going to kind of explore some of the things, Ian, that we experience in RNIB, some of the questions that parents will come to us in terms of questions around supporting children, kind of babies and toddlers. So I think one of the first things, and it comes up for us quite a lot, is when families are talking about, especially kind of babies, and they're talking about bonding. And I think people connect this with the, you know, eye contact between kind of parent and baby, and that kind of being a huge part of the bonding process. And a lot of parents will ask, if that child is not making that eye contact with them, how is that impacting on that experience of bonding, and what other things could they maybe be doing?
Yeah, so you know, this is an entirely legitimate question, and one that I think probably lots of parents would share. I think many of us, or most of us, would have some felt sense of the importance in kind of that eye contact and kind of initial bonding with the child. And of course it is important in bonding and attachment, but it's not kind of the whole story. It's not the only story. There are other ways you can kind of enhance that attachment relationship between a caregiver and a child. And when you think about it, the attachment relationship, it's kind of mediated to the baby or the infant's senses. So it's not just about sight, you know, mum's voice, mum's smell, as well as, of course, facial expressions, body language, eye contact. If mum and dad are kind of nurturing and kind of responsive to this child, it helps them to feel secure and kind of strong and more comfortable in exploring their surroundings. People talk about the idea of a safe base. I'm sure you've heard that before. It's the idea of, if I'm kind of safe and okay with my caregiver, I feel kind of confident to kind of go out there and kind of explore the world a bit. We'll attach some files to this podcast so people can kind of do some reading around it. But there's some kind of core ideas. I mean, if a child is securely attached, basically they think that they are aware that their emotional needs will be met responsively by their attachment figure. And responsively is kind of the most important word. If you think about the eye contact thing, it's about a kind of a caregiver who's present, who's kind of attending to your needs, who's kind of calm, who's responding to you. But that responsiveness, of course, can be shown in sort of different ways. A secure attachment, of course, is important, and you know there are lots of bits of research that suggest a secure attachment can be associated with greater capacity to manage your emotions in kind of childhood and adulthood, greater kind of efficacy, more ability to sort of do stuff. So you know the bonding attachment is important, and eye contact certainly is an important part of that. There is actually a very good RNIB document on this that I'd kind of encourage people to look at, and again we'll try and kind of link to that on the website beside this podcast. The steps that people can take, I mean, first things first, kind of if you're worried about bonding with your child, then read about attachment. There's loads of good literature out there. Much of the most accessible stuff is NHS stuff. There's lots of very helpful presentations and documents that we can link to. But looking at things through an attachment lens, you know, having that awareness of the importance of being responsive and available and attuned. You know, attuned is not a very good word. It's like when the child has a need, responding to it kind of quickly and kind of meaningfully, being aware of the kind of subtle signals that the child may be giving for, you know, attention, and be aware what those signals are for your own child. Take into account the level of visual impairment that child may have, you know, leaning towards you, you know, coming close, you know, making requests for joint attention with touch or with vocalizations rather than perhaps with eye contact. So there's that. So just seeing through things through an attachment lens will help massively. Having an awareness that a visually impaired child's reactions to things may be different to that which we were socialized to. By that, I suppose what I mean is we all have a sort of an awareness, like I said, of the importance of eye contact, and we're all socialized to look for certain things from others, including children, as signs that they're interested in us. So having a sense actually specifically of what's going on for your child and looking fairly deeply at that. So a good example is some visually impaired infants may become very quiet when they're listening for their caregiver to approach, rather than smiling or becoming excited as the person enters the room. From a kind of attachment perspective, you want the caregiver to be aware of the fact that this is just their way of kind of trying to kind of respond to or be available for their caregiver. They're not, you know, less available perhaps than the child who's jumping up and down and clapping. They're just using their senses to monitor for the approach of their, you know, important caregiving figure. So, you know, knowing that, knowing the child. There's something about working with parents too and understanding that, you know, that's, you know, raising children, having babies is sort of mega, mega stressful anyway. And parents being aware of their own needs therein, and being aware that actually, is there additional sort of stresses associated with caregiving or looking after or parenting their child who has additional needs? And knowing that actually the parental emotional needs in the parent-child dyad are important too. And if we want to try and look after that child and bond with it, we may have to think about our own psychological needs as well. The kind of third bit of it, I think, in this, I suppose, is just kind of getting close to your child, you know, spending time with them, interacting with them, you know, noticing and kind of responding to their attempts for attention. This is this idea of kind of attunement again. And, you know, it can be holding a toy with them, it could be listening to a song, it could be singing a song, you know, banging a drum, playing a game. Obviously, if they're distressed, kind of responding to that, picking them up, holding them, soothing them however you can, kind of talking them through it. So it's an awareness of their needs and a kind of attunement to and a responsiveness to. That means there are other ways to meet their needs solely than just kind of through eye contact, other ways to bond with them. One might presume that everyone around visually impaired children would make greater effort to discuss things with them and to explain where they are and just, I guess, to use their voices as adults to kind of engage with and communicate with that child. This is not actually always the case. I mean, there's some research that suggests, paradoxically, some people may actually talk less to visually impaired children than they would do with children with intact vision. If we're going to overcome the bonding and attachment challenges presented by, you know, the lack of or the relatively less eye contact, and obviously leaning in more to talking, more descriptions, more vocalization, which is going to help again to kind of overcome that and bond more with your child. So there's lots of ways to do it, and I guess, you know, I'm sure Karen would emphasize too kind of the importance of sort of playing together and just kind of being together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, that is really interesting listening to you, Ian. Some of the things that you're saying there, I've, you know, I've heard discussed before, and I've read about it as well. And I think a lot of the time it is just that reassurance for parents, isn't it? That, as you say, every parent's experience is different, and it is all about getting to know your child and getting to understand their needs and getting to sort of read them in a little way. And a lot of what you're doing here is allaying concerns of parents. Obviously, that's the whole point of this then, isn't it? But yeah, I was interested in what you were saying as well about finding different ways to actually do the bonding. I know that touch is so significant for a lot of children, particularly those with, you know, with very profound vision impairment. So I'm just interested to know what's your thoughts on things like infant massage in this context as well, because that's often cited as a good bonding activity. For all new parents, parents of new babies.
It's funny you say that, Karen. Actually, I was sitting thinking, what stuff have I forgotten to say? And baby massage is written in my notes. So yeah, massive fan. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's an overarching theme here, which I think is all the things that we're discussing as ways to bond with a baby would be good ways to bond with any baby. But of course, if we're kind of narrowing our focus down to visually impaired babies and infants, then of course our focus switches slightly to things which will be not kind of impacted upon by kind of the visual stuff. And of course, baby massage, touch, picking kids up, rocking babies, kind of all that kind of contact stuff, I think is massively, massively important. So yeah, no, we totally and emphatically agree with the importance of the touch stuff.
And it's a lovely thing for parents to do as well. It's an, you know, it's a really nice reciprocal activity. You know, it's just a lovely way for parents to really kind of experience that sort of getting close to the child. And again, it's a confidence issue. The more you do things like that, the more confident you become in things like handling the baby as well.
That's so kind of interesting to hear as well. And I think, as you're saying, it's a lot of parents are probably doing a lot of this without even realizing that they are kind of, you know, still kind of making those connections and you're kind of focusing on this one area. Ian, another thing, again, just kind of coming off again, I suppose, bonding is parents will often talk to us about, you know, maybe their baby being very anxious, that their baby doesn't want to be put down, they want to be held all the time. In terms of kind of what we've been talking about in bonding, what would that connection be, or why would a baby be feeling kind of that anxious maybe all the time?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It leads in from what Karen was just saying and what we kind of discussed a moment ago. Well, if you think about it, you know, a baby being super upset when it's not being held, it makes massive sense from a kind of evolution perspective, or just from a kind of survival perspective. You know, that baby's survival is completely contingent on its proximity to its caregivers. And I guess that in some senses is a lot of what attachment is actually about. If the baby is kind of confident that you're there, they're probably going to be calmer. If they're not terribly confident you're there, they're going to be more anxious. So in a sighted baby, you know, being able to kind of see you, and of course, you know, in early kind of infanthood, I guess their vision may not have incredible acuity, but if they can see you and be confident you're there, they're going to feel calmer. If they have kind of some other prompt, you know, if the baby is being held, for example, like you just mentioned, you know, if they're being held, they can hear the mother's voice or the, you know, main attachment figure's voice, they're going to feel kind of calmer too. So in the question, one of the things that's kind of, I think, implicit is the idea of, you know, compared to other kids, mine needs to be held a lot. And this, as I think Karen suggested a moment ago as well, it's just about a sort of level of awareness or an expectation that this is just going to take a wee bit longer. With one less sense to rely upon, it's going to take more time for that child to be confident that when they need you, you will be there. You know, when they feel threatened or afraid or in pain, you'll appear. So, you know, there's acceptance that's going to take some time. And then there's all the things that we've mentioned. There's kind of trying to move towards the baby rather than away from. You know, what they're doing is not pathological. You know, being with the baby, you know, singing, you know, rhyming with them, doing little back and forth noises, all that kind of cooing that, you know, you would do with a baby. Baby massage, as Karen rightly said, all this stuff, just to sort of reassure baby that, you know, you're going to be around, they can kind of feel you, and it's kind of okay. They don't need to be too worried. of course, like engaging other senses too. You know, if you are trying to put that baby down, I'm imagining probably in a cot to sleep, can you put them on an item of your clothing so they can smell you? So they have another sense reassuring them a bit that you're around. Is that going to kind of help them settle a bit? So whatever you can kind of load into that to kind of calm them down, obviously it's going to sort of massively help them. You know, using toys that make noises, all these things that can just provide a bit of a sense of kind of consistency and kind of familiarity, particularly in kind of novel environments, I think will probably help massively too. So these kind of developmental stages might just take that wee bit longer to work through, but it's about a kind of awareness of the strategies around other senses that can help them work through it and be calmer and more settled. And it's also about awareness of the fact that it's just going to take time. I mean, the one of the things that people often ask as well is the kind of putting kids down thing is at a kind of later developmental stage, encouraging kids to be more confident. So, you know, how do I get my child who's visually impaired to be more confident going out and doing things and kind of engaging with life?
Yeah.
And it's tricky, that stuff, right? With a child with some degree, particularly a significant visual impairment, then parents will, of course, share some degree of caution around that child going out and kind of doing its own thing. But there's kind of two oppositional or seemingly oppositional ideas here. There's the one about the safe base, you know, safe attachment base, keep things nice and sort of safe and, you know, calming for the child. But there's also the importance of introducing a degree of kind of measured adversity that the kid can kind of overcome. I mean, the best kind of way to understand this, I think, is if you think back to the things in maybe your own childhood you felt most kind of pride, or I guess a sense of achievement, or kind of, you know, autonomy in. You know, what sort of stuff was it? Was it kind of winning at sports? Was it kind of doing a presentation at school, or kind of standing up to a bully, or something else? If you think about it, most of the things about which you would feel most proud involve a degree of kind of jeopardy. You know, meeting something kind of that was kind of really challenging, and probably quite anxiety provoking, and kind of overcoming it. This is a sort of kind of transformative experience that you want to give kids, but it can be quite challenging to engineer. But it's what gives you confidence later on in life, and more confidence to try and then, you know, meet life head on and kind of do stuff. And also, you know, some sense of our own self-worth, I think, because we've overcome stuff, and a kind of a capacity to sort of regulate our own emotions. You know, if we've encountered anxiety and fear and overcome it, then we're kind of more confident in our capacity to manage those problematic emotions when they arise again. So, again, your toddler may take longer to develop confidence than their sighted peers. Working on that attachment relationship to give them that safe base will help, but then introducing sort of novelty. So, you know, can the other parents take them to the park or wherever? Can a grandparent? Can they spend time with the grandparents? Can they try new things? Having that sense of, I use the word adversity, maybe it's not quite the right one. It's adversity, it's novelty, it's provoking a wee bit of anxiety in that child, but in the context of a nice secure attachment relationship that they can then use to kind of overcome stuff kind of going forward. So it'll take time, but it'll kind of work out in the end. I mean, there is something in there, again, about managing our own anxiety too. Not so much with the cuddling the crying child that doesn't want to be put down, but certainly in the, you know, I'm worried about my kid going and doing stuff thing. You know, kids encountering adversity is good as long as it's safe. And, you know, I mean safe in a fairly kind of broad sense. You know, kids running around when they learn to walk and falling over and bumping their heads, it's not nice for anyone, but if they're not doing any damage to themselves, it's an instructive and useful experience for them. And again, you know, them getting a bit of a cuddle, a bit of reassurance, running off, bumping their head again, you know, it can be pretty repetitive. And it's not pleasant as a parent to sometimes have to see that. But, you know, a kid is testing the sort of limitations of their own aptitudes and skills. And this can be, the root of a lot of confidence and a lot of ability. And the parent giving them the child the freedom to do that doesn't necessarily just mean about walking, you know, first steps and falling over. It could mean, you know, letting child go and do stuff, you know, classes at school, or attempting to do certain extracurricular activities that you might be concerned about, the child is keen to do, and allow them to encounter that adversity or that challenge and kind of overcome it. So I think it's got to be both, right? It's got to be about safe attachment, particularly for the littler kids, and then when it's toddlers and infants, a focus on ensuring they have that safe base, but also ensuring they have that degree of novelty and adversity to engage with.
Yeah, so actually, just as you're saying that, like, that's a common thing that parents will bring up to you about, you know, for example, you know, a situation like a playground or out somewhere at a party or something, and children kind of maybe having a meltdown if they feel that they've kind of lost mum somewhere or they can't see. And again, kind of what you're saying, so that kind of being able to be that safe space, being able to respond to that as a parent, but still kind of encouraging them to go off and kind of explore as well. So I suppose some parents would ask about, you know, when children are getting that worried and that kind of anxious, how should they be handling that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, Karen said something I think pretty profound earlier, which is about understanding your own child's needs and kind of responding kind of to those needs with a high degree of attunement. What we want to do is encourage children to face up to situations that are novel with a degree of confidence. And there's obviously a sweet spot there. If you're asking them to do too much and they feel overwhelmed, they're going to be, you know, it's not going to be a useful or instructive experience. In fact, what will end up happening probably is they'll have to retreat from it. And what that'll serve to do, unfortunately, is probably emphasize to them that they're not as capable as perhaps they hoped. Perhaps in isolation, any of these things are not so bad, but, you know, in some, they can be a bit trickier. It's about having a series of these little experiments, perhaps, with your child, seeing where the limitations to their confidence perhaps lie, and then being prepared to just push them a little bit beyond that, knowing that they're able to do it, but not introducing them to situations that they feel recurrently kind of overwhelmed in, I'd say.
Sorry to just jump in at this point. It is really interesting, again, you know, listening to these ideas, because as Laura says, we do get a lot of questions around this. And again, a lot of it comes from parents' own anxieties rather than the child's actual abilities. But you, as you say, Ian, it's a very fine line and it's a difficult one to draw for any parent, but particularly a parent who has concerns about the way a child might manage certain situations. But it, I think a key message is always this whole idea of we do learn from our mistakes. And if we're not given the opportunity to make mistakes, albeit in a safe, you know, a structured, safe environment, then any child isn't ever going to have that opportunity to succeed in that sense. Like going back to what you were saying about, you know, those earliest memories of achievement are very often encased in a sense of it involving some kind of risk. You take the risk, it doesn't work out. You know, you can be put off doing something again, but more often than not, you draw learning from that. And then the next time you approach it a different way and find your own solutions. And again, very much about something as a service we see a lot about trying to find ways to help young children with the vision impairment develop that independence so that they can go on to meet whatever challenges, you know, life throws at them, just as any other young person does. I'm just wondering, it seems to kind of at this point lean into, we were talking about things like Laura mentioned there, about things like playgrounds and, you know, particular places where parents do, we find parents come to us as to sort of say that there are, how do we approach this? You know, I want my child to be able to engage in activities the same as any other child, but there are risks, there are things that we're not sure about. And play and interaction is definitely an area, I think Laura would agree, where we get lots and lots of questions. So Ian, I just wondered if there was anything in particular, I mean, you know, within RNIB, we have various resources, we have different areas of advice that we can offer on this, and I think we will add those to the podcast when that gets published. But in terms of concerns parents might have, particularly when their children are younger, about supporting them to interact with other children, for example, in the playground, are there any particular areas of advice that you could offer on that?
Yeah, it's a big one, isn't it? I think it's a big subject for a lot of parents and something that they have very significant concerns about. I would agree with what you said, Karen, that often kids will kind of get on with it and they'll sort of find their own way through this with eventually a degree of confidence, but initially it may be quite challenging. But of course, it's often the parents that have the greatest concern about it because they anticipate these challenges even before they're encountered. I mean, there is a reality, and the reality is that missing out in one element of input and interaction means that for visually impaired children, it can be challenging to engage with their sighted peers. Less aware of bits of the nonverbal communication, waving, thumbs up, all the other bits and pieces that might not be kind of immediately evident can, throw a few kind of spanners in the works when it comes to making that sort of communication run smoothly. Of course, it varies by child, it varies by the nature of the visual impairment, it varies by age. And there are things that can certainly be done to help. So, first things first, I mean, maximising any child's opportunity to socially interact with others is the big thing, I think. And if that's cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, whomever it is, just to kind of get their confidence up, firstly, in just having that interaction, but getting their confidence up in their own ability to ask the right sort of questions, to respond to people, just to know how they can be or could be in a kind of social setting, that experience is just enormously, enormously valuable. Engineering play dates with other kids, depending on your child's age, from school, from playgroup, from wherever your child's interacting with children the most, will help a huge amount. Depending on the age of the child, you can, of course, introduce an element of scaffolding. You can talk to your child about aspects of communication that you may have noticed they might struggle a wee bit with. That could be things like kind of posture, kind of helping them to orientate their kind of face towards the person speaking to kind of help kind of facilitate that sort of conversation. Again, like waving, kind of smiling, all these things. And again, it's a kind of iterative process, right? You encourage your child to kind of talk to you about it. You kind of hang out with them when they're doing it. You give them a wee bit of feedback, and hopefully you make it a bit easier for them to feel confident that they're hitting the right sort of marks in these sort of conversations. They're doing the right sort of stuff. And that's not just about their confidence. It's obviously about the conversation then flowing more easily with them and their peers. And of course, many kids with additional needs, not just visual impairment, but, potentially other sensory needs and others too, find other kids a bit of a challenge. They're kind of, children are noisy and kind of unpredictable and a bit more of a challenge than adults, who will probably be a bit more thoughtful in their interaction, communication with somebody when they know they have a visual impairment. They're a bit slower, they're a bit more patient, they're a bit easier to sort of engage with. So often it's the other kids that are more of the challenge than kind of other kind of adults. That's why we often see visually impaired children have a bit of a preference for, hanging out with, parents, friends, professionals at schools and things, because it's a bit more straightforward. There's kind of concerns, I guess, around actually how kids play and kind of with what. Some parents I know have some concerns around, children not really being able to find toys that they like, and that being a bit of an obstacle to not just playing with their peers, but also playing with members of the family and parents and stuff. Karen, I'll hand over to you in a second, because play is absolutely your wheelhouse, but it goes without saying, play is mega important. And in some senses, many people are concerned that children in kind of contemporary times miss out in some aspects of play, particularly unstructured play, which was far more pervasive, 10, 20, 30, certainly 40 years ago. So helping to support play and, if possible, unstructured play is great. Now, if you're trying to do something slightly more structured, of course, there's toys you can use, which a visually impaired child may be able to play with their sighted peers. Obviously, RNIB has loads and loads on their shop that people can kind of use, which will help. Again, just using different sort of social settings, different areas where kids could go to and play to get a bit more sense of how, as well as the sort of the tools they use and specifically the toys. People worry about iPads and sort of phones and the use of sort of innovative technologies and things. And that's, again, it's legitimate to worry about these things. They can be a great resource and in some senses a useful equaliser. There's multiplayer games kids can play on iPads with very little vision, and in fact with some of them, zero perception of light, that they can still use the iPad with and play with their peers. Parents are worried about overusing technology. The Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health published guidance probably a couple of years ago now that I thought hit the nail on the head. It talked about the idea of technology is in of itself not a problem. It's if that technology displaces other important activities. So, you know, is your child spending enough time with their peers? Are they spending enough time with the family? Are they getting enough fresh air and sunlight? Are they, you know, are they using tech at mealtimes? Are they having a decent kind of sleep routine? You know, if all the kind of positive stuff is falling into place and they're using the iPad's probably not a concern. If the iPad is displaced any of these important things, then perhaps the iPad is. But technology can obviously be an enormously useful kind of tool in helping kids as well. Karen, I don't know, what would you make of all this? This is your
I was just going to say, actually, and I think particularly for children with vision impairment, technology becomes absolutely invaluable as they grow older as a means of them being able to sort of independently, you know, it's so fundamental to a lot of children's learning now, classroom learning, and we know that that technology, as it changes and develops all the time, is becoming more and more accessible and is making the world more accessible for children with vision impairment. So yeah, completely agree. It is a question that comes up a lot though, isn't it? And I think it is a fear, but what you've just said there is really reassuring, and I think that's the way to do it. It's the balance, isn't it? If the technology or the interest in technology is taking over interest in other activities and interactions, then that's when to start thinking about kind of cutting back on it. It was nice of you to mention our resources there, Ian. We do have lots of different things, and I know right at the start of this, Laura was saying about we were talking about opportunities for sort of play dates and things and getting children together. We do know that that can be a concern, and obviously in the context of the last couple of years as well, where people haven't been able to get together physically so much, children have been missing out on a lot of social interaction, you know, which is something that I think has been the cause of a lot of concern, particularly with our parents or with parents that come to us as a service. So yeah, I think opportunities, finding those opportunities. And one thing I always remember, this is something that I remember hearing about when I was relatively new to this role, but it's a really good bit of advice, I think, and as ever it came from parents themselves that we spoke to, that in terms of a lot of the time that sort of initial broaching the idea of, oh, my child is visually impaired and, you know, I want my child to play with other children who predominantly, if they go to a mainstream school, will be sighted, that often talking about vision impairment can be quite tricky. And parents sort of have told us that they often get involved in practicing key sentences that they can say to new people in new social situations, you know, just to kind of get over that initial, okay, you know, we're on a playground, your child has noticed that my child, you know, can't see in the same way that they do. How can we teach, you know, how can we ourselves as parents talk to other parents about that, but also encouraging the child to have those kind of conversations. And more often than not, children are really happy to talk to other children about their eye condition, aren't they? You know, they're not usually as shy about those kind of things. But yeah, we'll put some links to a couple of resources, one of which focuses very much on social interaction, which is called Parties and Play Dates. And there's a few other links on this topic. It is a massive topic and we could talk for ages about it. But we do have a really lovely resource called Let's Play, which is advice for families on different elements of activities and certain recommendations for toys that are not necessarily designed for children with vision impairment, because most of the toys in there are actually just mainstream toys, but that do offer developmental opportunities and are appealing to children with vision impairment. Just on the idea of development there, we also do get quite a lot of questions on that area, with parents often wondering whether or not they should be concerned if their child doesn't appear to be hitting milestones or hitting them later than perhaps their sighted siblings have been doing. Is there anything in that area that, Ian, you think might be useful advice for parents?
Yeah, so I mean, there is a sort of general principle, and I think the research on this is relatively unequivocal, which is, you know, children with a significant visual impairment do tend to mature at a somewhat slower pace with regard to kind of developmental milestones compared with sighted children, but they get there eventually. And in some senses, again, if this is an overarching theme of this discussion today, it's about a degree of awareness of that and an element, I suppose, of just patience. For the vast majority, they'll get there eventually. And if they don't, that can't be something that's discussed with, you know, whatever medical professionals, be it, you know, ophthalmologist or kind of community paediatrician or whomever the child is under the care of. So, you know, holding awareness that it's in some senses to be expected, but it's not unreasonable just to kind of keep a bit of an eye on it and make sure that it's something that they attain their developmental milestone kind of eventually. I mean, there's a massive question. The massive question, I guess, is kind of how does a visual impairment impact a child's development more broadly? And it's kind of far too big for us to kind of really wrestle with in the time we have today. But it's worth acknowledging, I suppose, that it does. And it does in ways that are, in some senses, predictable, and in some senses, somewhat less predictable, probably. You know, if you think about it, you know, the human brain is tremendously kind of flexible. The word that people tend to use is neuroplasticity, which means that, you know, the brain will adapt to stuff that's kind of put in front of it. So, you know, a human brain will adapt to its environment in ways that are, again, kind of remarkable and in some sense quite unexpected. You know, one of the famous examples is London cabbies have areas of the brain associated with kind of, you know, directions and kind of locations in space that are kind of larger than, you know, people who aren't London cabbies, because again, the brains have adapted to the idea of just constantly kind of, you know, having to locate and navigate through London. I imagine it's a bit less of a thing these days with kind of smartphones, but it certainly used to be a thing. In visually impaired children, I guess, of course, the brain is responding to having one very significant sense less as an input. And that's not just existing in isolation either. It's kind of existing also in accordance with the other senses. So, you know, senses don't exist in isolation. They kind of map onto and kind of integrate with each other. You know, Karen, I'm sure you encountered plenty of kids that have sort of issues with sensory integration. You know, senses that they have, you know, sound, sight, whatever, they often experience them as being overwhelming. And that's because, I guess, you know, for the vast majority of people, senses tend to integrate with one another in ways that feel either completely unremarkable or kind of entirely kind of satisfying. So not having that input means potentially other senses are a bit less well realized initially. But of course, in the longer term, kind of people catch up with too. There's other things that are just kind of worth kind of mentioning and kind of passing, I guess. Certain things obviously are noted in visually impaired children sometimes that are a consequence of these changes in brain development or in kind of broader child development. So, you know, lack of representational play, presence of kind of what we'd call kind of stereotypic kind of movements, kind of hand flicking, finger rocking, spinning, swaying and stuff, often lead to visually impaired children being kind of hypothesized as or diagnosed with autism or other kind of neurodevelopmental problems. Now, that's not to say visually impaired children can't be on the autistic spectrum. They can, of course, be on the autistic spectrum. And some conditions may predispose a child to being both visually impaired and kind of autistic. But I know a number of parents to whom I've spoken who've become quite frustrated by health systems that don't pick up on this nuance, that these sort of behaviours are actually, in some senses, expected and fairly predictable in somebody who is significantly visually impaired and are often a means of sort of, you know, regulating their issues with senses being integrated or not, or just regulating kind of being stressed. So it's kind of useful to note that the changes in development can lead to unhelpful hypotheses being formed by kind of others. There is this kind of cliche, and it's one that's worth mentioning just in passing now, which is the idea of the loss of one sense leads to greater acuity in the others. And actually, while it's a cliche, there's obviously very solid evidence for it too. And in fact, there's actually fairly solid evidence from brain scans and things that the brains of visually impaired individuals show kind of greater activity in those areas that would have been associated with vision, which are now associated with hearing or touch or other senses too. So neuroplasticity is kind of a good thing. It allows people to kind of take on greater kind of acuity in other areas of their senses due to the loss of one, or greater capacities in other areas due to being visually impaired. So there's that too. So it's a massive area, the differences in development. And again, I'm sure we'll find some very useful RNIB descriptions and resources to link to from this podcast, because if people are interested, understanding that better, or understanding that as well as is humanly possible, can really help you to be an asset in guiding your child through not just healthcare scenarios, but also through education, where often people have very little experience in supporting visually impaired children, and again, may misinterpret elements of the presentation meaning other things. And lastly, just before I forget, one of the other things that gets misinterpreted is body language is an interesting one. You know, if you are not socialized to, you know, sit in a certain way and, you know, face a certain way and orient your body towards somebody speaking in a certain way, that can be misinterpreted as a sign of, you know, low mood or depression, or, you know, otherwise kind of being pretty desperate and down, when in fact it may not be a sign of that at all. It may just be a developmental difference that was a fairly direct result of being visually impaired. And again, being sensitized to that and aware of that means you can be kind of more responsive to your child's emotional needs and help others to be more responsive too, which I think is important.
Oh, Ian, you've just touched on so much stuff that kind of that parents kind of, you know, would talk about as well. And again, just within that last kind of few minutes, that could be another series of podcasts in itself. Because again, that thing where we're again, you know, maybe professionals in a school or medical professionals might misunderstand some of those kind of characteristics as being something else. Again, that's kind of really, really common thing that comes up as well. And just in kind of talking about, the sensory element, I know, Karen, you've done kind of quite a lot around sensory play, kind of messy, muddy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I suppose that helps develop that kind of those senses and things as well. There's probably, again, Karen, you can probably explain better about what the value of that is.
Yeah, absolutely. I just thought it was really interesting then that actually almost, Ian, as we've gone kind of full circle, that your last comment there was all about, you know, understanding, reading the child and being more attuned to the individual child, because I think that's what we always say, isn't it? Every child's an individual, and how they respond and react to different situations obviously is very much down to their own sense of individuality as well. Yeah, I mean, in terms of just going back a little bit, I suppose for things like development, and actually touching on a lot of the things we've talked about, if anybody's interested in looking at finding specific ideas for activities, development activities, play activities, I've mentioned the Let's Play resource as well, before, which is really nice for some general ideas about that. But there's also something that we do, which is, as Laura's just mentioned there, which is called Messy and Muddy. And that was written with a habilitation specialist who talks about, we cover things like this, you know, the idea of allowing children to take risks. There's even strategies in there that she discusses about actually things that parents can practice with their children in terms of safe ways to fall. I think, Ian, you mentioned about, you know, letting the child run and they are going to fall, but there are actually ways that you can help a child with vision impairment learn to fall safely, or to mitigate, you know, any injury that might happen if they do have a little bit of a trip and a fall. So, I mean, it's you know, I could talk for absolutely hours about all these different strategies, but I think a nicer thing might be just to let parents kind of dip into these resources and pull out what's helpful to them, depending on what their individual questions are.
Yeah, I think just again, we kind of almost feels like we're kind of just scratching the surface with this, and we've kind of come to the end of the time. So if anyone does have any questions, please do get in touch with one of the team who can kind of point you in the right direction of resources or further support in anything discussed in the podcast. And please have a look at some of our older podcasts in the series. Thanks very much, Karen. Thanks very much, Ian, for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
If you found this helpful, you can listen to further podcasts in this series. You can find additional information at rnib.org.uk/children or email our team directly on cypf@rnib.org.uk. You can also call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. And for further information on Fight Against Blindness, visit fightagainstblindness.org. RNIB, see differently.